Good afternoon. So today's podcast is on a bit of a cardiology themed topic today, pericarditis. So what we'll cover in the podcast today will be, what is your pericardium? What is pericarditis? How common is it? What causes it? So a bit into the pathophysiology, and then how do we diagnose pericarditis. The first point to consider is, what is the pericardium? So pericardium has got two layers, okay? So it's got two layers, and it's a sac surrounding the heart. So two layers, and it's a sac surrounding the heart. What are the two layers? Okay, so there is a parietal and a visceral layer. The visceral layer lies in close proximity to your epicardium, and you've then got a parietal layer which has more nerve endings than the visceral layer. There is a space between the visceral and the parietal pericardium, which has a small amount of fluid in. This small amount of fluid usually is quoted as helping the dynamics of the heart. So it ranges by age, by gender, but it's somewhere in the ballpark of 20 to 50 mils, so not a huge amount of fluid. So when we then talk, well, that's the pericardium, then pericarditis is inflammation of this pericardial sac. Okay, and of all of the pathologies that can occur of the pericardium, pericarditis is by far the most common. Okay, pericarditis can occur on its own or with other pathologies of the pericardium, such as a pericardial effusion, cardiac tamponade, constrictive pericarditis. When we get pericardial inflammation, we can also get pericardial effusion, so fluid accumulating within this pericardial sac that normally houses between 20 and 50 mils of serous fluid. This effusion can be filled with blood, it can be filled with infections, it can be hemorrhagic or purulent, or it can be filled with serous fluid, which is the normal constituent of the pericardial fluid. When does this become a problem? So imagine if we had someone with pericarditis, which we said can occur on its own or in association with another pericardial syndrome. So if we've got someone with pericarditis and an associated pericardial fluid, what's the problem if the effusion becomes too much? So if there is a lot of fluid, so a large pericardial effusion, or the accumulation of fluid maybe isn't as high, but the rate of accumulation is high, fluid can compress the heart. So this fluid is extrinsic. So this fluid is outside of the heart. If it becomes too much, it can compress the heart. Why does this become a problem? Well, extrinsic compression of the heart is one of the limiting factors for diastolic filling. Okay, so filling of the chambers in the resting phase, so not the pumping phase, in the filling phase. So you can get diastolic impairment, and this is one of the things that leads to cardiac tamponade. Okay, so you can then become shocked, obviously, because the heart has impaired filling. So you can become clinically shocked because of these syndromes. Okay? Important things to think about. Okay. So the best guidelines that we look at are the European Society of Cardiology guidelines for looking at how to classify these things, because there's so many different causes of pericarditis, it makes sense to have some classification. So the guidelines that most journals will talk about will be these European Society of Cardiology guidelines. And a really, really good way at first outset of classifying pericarditis is infectious and non-infectious. So if you were to describe the infective agents that can cause pericarditis, you would be here all day. Lots of common organisms can cause pericarditis. The one that I want you to be aware of is when someone says, what causes pericarditis? You can say infectious and non-infectious. And what I want you to think about, what I really want you to think about, is viruses, bacteria and fungi, in that order. Viruses first, because they're the most common. Bacteria second, because they're the second most common infectious cause. And then fungi, rarer, but I want you to think about them in those categories. So viruses. The barn door one that you need to know for exams is the Coxsackie viruses. Okay? The Coxsackie viruses. Okay? Very important to be aware of Coxsackie and their role in pericarditis. So when someone says to you, what are the causes of pericarditis? So you're in an exam, you think, okay, viruses, bacteria and fungi, in that order, okay? Go through it again. Viruses, bacteria and fungi. They're the ones that you need to think about, okay? They're the ones that you really need to think about first and foremost. So, Coxsackie A and Coxsackie B. You've then got other ones such as parvovirus B19, which causes your slap cheek illness in children and can cause aplastic anemia. HIV and actually the flu virus, influenza, as well as herpes, Epstein-Barr virus associated with glandular fever, and cytomegalovirus. So there's loads of different causes. I don't want you to remember all of them. Remember Coxsackie, okay? So bacterial pericarditis occurs infrequently in the developed world, but more commonly in the developing world. So in some parts of Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, as well as being in countries where TB is more common, actually, in some countries, tuberculous pericarditis is more common than viral. So if we then think viruses, think Coxsackie virus. If you think about bacteria, have an example, okay? Have an example of bacteria. So for example, Mycobacterium tuberculosis. Other things, staph, strep, the common things can cause it. Pericarditis can be caused by fungi, for example, candida, or parasitic species such as toxoplasma. So just think about this. If you've got someone with fungal or parasitic causes of pericarditis, think immunocompromised, because these tend to be opportunistic organisms. Non-infectious, so we've covered infectious, so we said infectious, we've got virus, bacteria, fungi, and we've also tagged on parasites there. Non-infectious causes are very interesting. So malignancy. This is often metastatic phenomenon, okay, metastatic spread of a primary. Connective tissue disorders, you're looking at your lupus, you're looking at rheumatoid arthritis, and you're looking at Betts disease. Okay? Betts disease. And your, whatever it is, your HLA B27. Metabolic etiologies happen, so myxedema, so thyroid dysfunction, and uremia. So patients with chronic kidney disease can develop a uremic pericarditis. What else can cause it? So if I was to say to you, a patient who has had acute coronary syndrome, okay, acute coronary syndrome, who has developed pericarditis. So this is your concept of Drechsler syndrome, okay? So it's been recognized for decades. So acute coronary syndrome, then a delayed inflammatory response, normally a few weeks after the initial cardiac insult. And they think that they are antibodies against your myocardium. Okay? So that's what we think. Okay? That's what we think. So that's one of the other things that can happen. Okay? Remember as well, when you do any operation on the heart, you run the risk of damaging the pericardium. Okay? So that's what we think about. Okay? So drugs, we often neglect medications. Classical medications, such as isoniazid, is obviously an anti-TB medication, which is also mentioned as a potential cause of drug-induced pericarditis. And a quick piece of homework, what side effect is isoniazid associated with? Which classical one for exams? Will probably be worth a Google after or during the podcast. Your monoclonal antibodies as well have an increase in evidence base now of being associated with it. Okay. And you also need to think about seeing one case of someone with pericarditis secondary to sarcoidosis with a raised serum ACE level. Knowing all of this is great for exams, and it is really important. Just be aware that about 90% of patients with pericarditis, we have no clear cause, and a diagnosis of idiopathic acute pericarditis is made. So really important to be aware of that. So if you have an exam question, and what is the most common cause of pericarditis, it is often, we hate to say it, idiopathic in 90% cases, because it is frustrating, because time and effort for both yourselves and the patient go into trying to establish a clear etiology. But in 90% of cases, you never find one. You don't find the lupus or the rheumatoid arthritis or the malignancy that you're potentially looking for. So acute pericarditis is a common cause of chest pain, okay? And it's more common in men. Why does it happen? So back to anatomy, because you can't understand pericarditis properly unless you know a little bit of anatomy. So why have a pericardium? Okay, so it's an anchor to the heart within the thoracic cavity to help stabilize the heart. It forms a physical barrier to infection. Okay, it protects the heart from becoming infected. And the pericardium itself helps cardiac dynamics, so it helps the heart function better. Okay? You don't need a pericardium to be alive. There have been case reports of people of absence of the pericardium, and they've been perfectly healthy and disease free. So having a pericardium isn't essential for survival, but it helps. Okay? So we've recently been able to challenge this idea that the pericardium is essential for cardiac dynamics, because patients without a pericardium have had echocardiograms and their ejection fraction has been normal in pretty much all of the cases. So we've challenged the belief that it has this big function with cardiac dynamics. So that's been challenged over the past 10 years. So we said earlier on, you've got two layers. So you've got a visceral pericardium and you've got a parietal pericardium. Remember that we said that it's the parietal layer that is very rich in nerves, okay? So because there's such a rich nerve innervation, any inflammation, be that infectious or non-infectious, can result in retrosternal chest pain, so pain behind the sternum, okay? Over 90% of pericarditis have chest discomfort or chest pain, okay? Fine. So why do we worry? I said earlier on, why do we worry that if fluid accumulates quickly in pericardial disease, why is it a bad thing? Well, we know that pericardial compliance, okay, pericardial compliance can increase over a period of time, okay? So pericardial compliance can increase over a period of time. And my favourite definition of compliance, which I think is quite important in this case, is when I'm talking about that the compliance of the pericardium goes up, I talk about compliance in a very simple way. So that's how easily a chamber of the heart, so we could talk about ventricular compliance, we could talk about anything, or the lumen of a blood vessel, so we could talk about aortic compliance, expands when it's filled with a volume of blood, okay? So if we put that into an equation, compliance is change in volume divided by change in pressure. Change in volume divided by change in pressure. So when we're talking about that the pericardium, the compliance can go up, can increase in response to slowly accumulating fluid. That means, remember our equation, okay, with compliance. Compliance is how easily a chamber of the heart or lumen of a blood vessel or pericardial compartment, pericardial sac, can expand when it's filled with a volume of blood. So increased compliance means it can move more, it can accommodate more. So if that happens slowly, that can happen without extrinsic compression of the heart. So the rate of fluid accumulation is crucial, and many cardiac physiologists say it's more important than the actual volume of an effusion. So if the volume of fluid in the pericardium goes up slowly over a longer period of time, your compliance, which again, we'll go through it one more time because it's one of the critical concepts to understand in the heart. Compliance is how easily a chamber of the heart or the lumen of a blood vessel, or in this case, pericardium, can expand when it's filled with a volume of blood. Okay, very important. So it is far more important that the rate of fluid accumulation is critical rather than necessarily the volume of fluid. Okay, so there you go. So paradoxically, people go, well, hang on a minute. How can this person have cardiac tamponade if they've got this tiddly little pericardial effusion? And how can this person with metastatic cancer has got a massive pericardial effusion, but it is an incidental finding? Okay? Because rapid accumulation does not give you time to increase the compliance of your pericardium.
happens over a longer period of time, the amount you can distend and accumulate that volume goes up in a fairly linear relationship with the rate of fluid accumulation. If that becomes disturbed and you rapidly accumulate fluid but haven't got the time to increase the compliance of your pericardium, then you have big problems with cardiac dynamics and therefore run the risk of cardiac tamponade. So, broadly speaking, acute pericarditis, okay, if it's less than 4 weeks, okay? Some people then say chronic pancreatitis if it's lasted for more than 3 months. And then incessant pericarditis if it's somewhere between 4 weeks and 3 months. That, as you can imagine, is quite a broad interval. Recurrent pericarditis is if you have an episode that recurs after being symptom-free for about 4 to 6 weeks. Why do you need to know about pericarditis? Well, because 5% of non-ischemic emergency department chest pain admissions are acute pericarditis, okay? So you will, as a medical student, more commonly as an F1 or F2 when you're on take or working in A&E, you will easily rack up seeing 20 patients with chest pain, okay? Of those 20 patients with chest pain, okay, with those 20 patients with chest pain, one of them will statistically have pericarditis. So you don't have to see many patients with chest pain for you to make that diagnosis or to statistically see someone with pericarditis. The classic presentation you're looking for and is in the history, and it's the thing that you're listening for when you ask someone, is you say to someone, well, where is the chest pain? And they say it's central. You go, oh, interesting. It's often severe and pleuritic. So it's worsened with deep inspiration. And it's positional. So it's improved by sitting up and leaning forward. Okay? So if it is improved by sitting up and leaning forward, if it's central, severe and pleuritic, you think pericarditis. Okay. One thing that I was unaware of when I learned about pericarditis, but saw it in one patient that I clerked, that didn't make sense to me, but makes sense now. You can get pain in your trapezius muscles, and your phrenic nerve passes in close proximity to pericardium. So pericardial inflammation can irritate your phrenic nerve and you can have pain in the trapezius muscles, okay? If you have got myocarditis, okay, the pain will be less classical and you can get symptoms of shortness of breath with that as well. How do we differentiate? The big thing that if someone comes in with severe central chest pain is you want to go, well, hang on a minute. Is this an ischemic event? Is this acute coronary syndrome? So, lo and behold, there are ways of doing it. So, pericardial pain is different from ischemic chest pain. So, ischemic chest pain worsened by exertion and emotion and improved with rest or GTN. Ischemic pain, non-positional, so isn't relieved by sitting forward, non-pleuritic, isn't made worse with a deep inspiration, and non-reproducible with palpation. Okay? The distinction between the two is very difficult, and emergency departments across the United Kingdom and the world struggle with this differentiation, okay? And often these patients will have chest x-rays, they will have high sensitivity troponin tests done, CRP, white cell count, EC, serial ECGs, to try and tease out, is this angina? Is it acute coronary syndrome? Is it pericarditis? So if the chest pain was pleuritic, but doesn't get any better by you sitting up or leaning forward, but was associated with a productive cough, you're probably more likely thinking this is respiratory. If you have got lower chest pain that improves your leaning forward, non-pleuritic, you might think, is this acute pancreatitis? Or is this esophagitis? So remember how all of those anatomical structures that are in your chest, it's worth taking the time to think, what is the most likely cause in this particular patient in front of me? So, talking of respiratory symptoms. So, the differential diagnosis for chest pain should include lots of different things. So let's think of a few things. So we're going to take a slight break here to talk about other causes of chest pain, and then we're going to go back to reveal some of the really important things with pericarditis. Okay. Other thing that's called chest pain, list them in your head. So we have got angina, okay? We've got acute coronary syndrome. We have got aortic stenosis that can cause subendocardial ischemia. Hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, especially delve into, is there a family history of sudden cardiac death? Aortic dissection, pulmonary embolism, pneumonia, and esophageal spasm. Okay, that's really important. We need to think about acute pancreatitis as well. So really important for you to think about all the other things. Remember that the SAD symptoms of aortic stenosis are syncope, angina, and dyspnea, okay? So the angina bit could give you central chest pain. So you need to think about other causes. Many patients who were suspected pericarditis have a CTPA and they've had a pulmonary embolism. So it's important to be very broad in what you think. When you are taking the history, characterize the pain. What makes it better? What makes it worse? What's it relieved by? Important medical history as well, any predisposing factors for venous thromboembolism. So what are the classic findings when you listen to the chest? Well, a pericardial friction rub, normally left parasternal, okay? It sounds scratchy is probably the best word. And it's due to the friction between the inflamed pericardial layers, okay? So that's very important, okay? If you can't hear it, tips and tricks for being able to hear it. You need to listen multiple places in the precordium, so over the chest. And I would listen to multiple positions. The one that you probably want to do is the left lateral position. So the left lateral position, that's what I would do, the person laying on their left hand side. And I would listen using the diaphragm and at end expiration. So ask the person to breathe out, okay? Take a deep breath out. I would listen multiple times. So I would, the typical thing that has happened for me in the past is I have listened when I initially clerked the patient. I have then gone back to take some blood tests or what have you, or they've had an ECG and I've thought, oh, which we'll talk about in a second, there's some ECG features, and I've then re-listened and heard a rub. If at first, if your clinical suspicions, you're thinking this could be pericarditis, listen multiple times. Patients aren't going to mind, okay? And with these patients, because they tend to be in considerable amount of pain if it's pericarditis, it is worth time permitting to go back and have a quick chat to them and re-listen, okay? I would be honest with you, please, if you listen to the four valve areas and the left precordium and you don't hear it, get the person onto their left-hand side Listen with your diaphragm at end expiration. If you still don't hear it, do not despair. Go back later on. And you know what? Sometimes it's your third or fourth time listening and you think you're going a bit cuckoo. And it's the standard thing. When the consultant listens on the post-take ward round, they will hear it. Okay? And it's probably just that it's present there because the layers are rubbing against each other and you're hearing that rub and it just wasn't present before. If you think someone's got pericarditis, listen multiple times in the left lateral position, end expiration. And if it is pericarditis, you increase your chances of hearing a pericardial rub. Once heard, never forgotten. Okay? So that's what we need to think about. Okay. So, how do you differentiate between a pericardial rub and a pleural rub? Easy. Pleural rubs are associated with respiration. You get the person to stop breathing. If you can hear it, okay, it's a pericardial rub. Okay, remember, a pleural rub is related to respiration. Okay, a pericardial rub is associated with the cardiac cycle. Get them to hold their breath. If you can hear it when they're holding their breath, it's a pleural rub. If you can't hear it, it's a pericardial rub, which is another important examination tip. Take your time when examining someone with suspected pericarditis. Take your time. Ask them to hold their breath, see if it's still present. Where is it loudest? And if in doubt, you can always examine the patient. If you hear something, YouTube a pericardial rub. And if that sounds like what you've just heard, and you can marry the two up, then you probably are right and it's a pericardial rub. 50% of patients will have typical ECG changes, okay? There is huge variability in this, so I want you to take it with a pinch of salt. Classically, when pericarditis was first described, they talked about four phases of ECG changes, okay? So, stage one is when you get this concave ST segment elevation, okay? And you get ST depression in AVR, okay? So that's what tends to happen. You also tend to get PR elevation. So your PR segment goes up in AVR. So ST segment elevation, this diffuse concave ST segment elevation, and you get PR elevation in AVR with ST depression. So remember that. Remember in pericarditis to look at AVR as well. If you've got PR segment elevation and ST depression in AVR, that is one of the features that can make you think this is acute pericarditis. Okay? You can get pericarditis changes in some of the leads, but they tend to be diffuse. You tend to get them across your chest leads. Stage two is when those ST and PR changes normalize. Stage three and stage four are when you get widespread T wave inversions. Okay? So the ST elevation, unlike acute coronary syndrome, will be diffuse rather than localized. It won't be confined to a coronary artery territory. Okay? So ST elevation is a concave down shape, concave up with pericarditis, concave up, pericarditis. I remember cup, so concave up, pericarditis, CUP, cup. So concave up, pericarditis, okay? Pericarditis is also associated with these reciprocal ST changes, okay? Okay, so these reciprocal changes, okay? When you're looking at reciprocal changes, if it's only in AVR that we talked about earlier on, you're thinking pericarditis. If it's in multiple leads, you're thinking acute coronary syndrome, okay? And the presence of Q waves supports a diagnosis of acute coronary syndrome. So if you have got ST elevation, the serious thing that you want to rule out is acute coronary syndrome. If you've ruled out acute coronary syndrome through investigation, then you're going to think, okay, I've ruled out acute coronary syndrome. What else could it be? So we've got this benign early repolarization pattern commonly seen in healthy individuals, okay? Which you can see in several leads, and it's when your J point, so Google J point, goes up, okay? And J point elevation is more associated with benign early repolarization. So if we're thinking clinically, how do you make a diagnosis? The characteristic chest pain and a pericardial rub is how you diagnose it. However, you still need other stuff to confirm the diagnosis. So the criteria, and I want you to remember this because you need at least two of these four criteria to diagnose it. European Society of Cardiology. Number one, you need pericardial chest pain. Number two, pericardial rub. Three, new widespread ST elevation or PR depression. And four, pericardial effusion, either a new one or a one that was known previously and worsening, usually seen on echo. Supporting findings, raised CRP and white cell count. Okay? Fine. So that's what we're looking at. Treatment. What would you do if you suspected someone with pericarditis? ECG, echo, chest x-ray. You should also have troponins. Okay, troponins. So these are the tests that I would do as like a first line thing. So I would do full blood count, urea and electrolytes, liver function tests, thyroid function, okay? Because we said the association with myxedema. If you suspected a septic active infection, you could consider blood cultures if they fulfilled a sepsis screen. You can get an echo if there's problems. Cardiac CT, okay, is another thing that can be done. Patient's got tamponade, they tend to have pericardiocentesis. Okay, pericardiocentesis. So, how do we treat it? Well, really, if someone's got uremic pericarditis, we need to look at how often are we dialyzing these patients. Okay. If they've got TB, then obviously management for TB as well. So most patients get better with fairly conservative management. So I want to be very clear when I say this. I want to be very clear when I say this. They require high dose steroids. Okay? So, in the majority of patients, giving patients anti-inflammatory drugs, you can have to give them up to 2 weeks. Okay? So, you can give ibuprofen 600 milligrams three times a day. You can use indomethacin, you can use naproxen, or you can use aspirin. The important point I want to make with aspirin is the aspirin you can give like 100 milligrams four times a day. That really frightens people. So it's important to counsel not just the patient, but the nursing staff as well. So on cardiology, we had a patient who was due to be going home over the weekend. And we clearly put in a handover that this patient was to go home on, I think it was 600 milligrams of ibuprofen three times a day. I've seen it in similar situations with patients on quite substantial doses of aspirin, sometimes 500 milligrams of aspirin, really, really high doses of aspirin multiple times a day, but it is licensed for it. So we'd handed over this and we'd put on the take home, and he was due to go home if his chest, because he was in a huge amount of chest pain. If his chest pain got better and he was clinically stable, we can consider getting him home. So you can use a huge amount of aspirin, okay? You can, I have gone up to sometimes 900 milligrams every 4 to 6 hours with a maximum dose of kind of 4 grams per day. So I've sometimes given 900 milligrams 4 times a day, which obviously gives you a dose of 3.6 milligrams over the course of a day. I've done that, and it's well-known practice in pericarditis. You have to give them quite high doses of NSAIDs. Often patients, these drug doses will be queried and they'll get dropped down. The problem is if patients go home with suboptimal analgesia, they'll come back with worsening pericarditis. So it's important to give them the correct thing. This is not someone with long-term bit of pain in their knee. This is an incredibly disabling and painful pericardial syndrome. So that's really important. If patients can't tolerate non-steroidals, or if they've got severe renal impairment, your patients with uremic pericarditis, give them colchicine. There was a trial called the COPE trial, C-O-P-E, which basically showed that colchicine was as good, if not better, than NSAIDs. If they're not suitable for colchicine, okay, or NSAIDs, that's very important to know. Severe renal impairment, you can't give colchicine, and you can't give colchicine to pregnant or lactating women. Pred is something that you can give, especially if you think it might be an autoimmune phenomenon, okay? If they've got an autoimmune pathology, steroids can work quite nicely. And then you're looking then at IVIG and other things if those things don't work properly. So how do you manage it? Pretty high doses of non-steroidals. You're not giving them forever. Give them a PPI, a proton pump inhibitor as well. Doesn't have to be particularly high dose. Something like 15 milligrams of lansoprazole, or give them some omeprazole for 2 weeks as gastroprotection if you're giving them high dose NSAIDs. And then remember what the COPE trial said, that colchicine is good and definitely an option. And then prednisolone is also an option as well. So what do we know? Well, we talked about what pericarditis is. Well, the pericardium is anatomically consisting of the visceral and parietal pericardium. We've talked about you have a small amount of fluid between 20 and 50 mil that helps these layers glide over each other, provides lubrication for good cardiac dynamics. And what can cause pericarditis? We talked about infectious and non-infectious. We've talked about the classical features of this severe retrosternal chest pain that is relieved on sitting forward with the pleuritic component. We talked about the ECG changes, where we talk about widespread diffuse ST segment elevation. Remember that we said cup. So with pericarditis, we're looking at concave upward slanting segments in pericarditis, okay, which is important. And the reciprocal changes in AVR. Always look at AVR when you're looking at ECG of someone with suspected pericarditis. We talked about the management, high dose non-steroid anti-inflammatory drugs. If they are not suitable, okay, they are not suitable, then we can look at giving other medications, for example, colchicine. Okay, we're going to give them colchicine. If colchicine doesn't work or is unsuitable, we can also talk about other things. Weirdly, some patients respond really well to paracetamol, which is something that happens. It has happened in the past. Some patients have been found to have pericarditis afterwards and they've just been given paracetamol. Paracetamol is, of course, an option, as with any type of pain. It's just that we tend to favour non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs first. Colchicine's an option. And remember that low to moderate dose prednisolone can be used, more preferable in patients with a suspected autoimmune etiology to their symptoms. Thank you very much for listening to the podcast.